So, Cargill, let's do even littler than Doolittle and say you can just talk to one animal. What animal would...
One animal or one type of animal?
One type of animal. Yeah, what would that be?
I would go dogs. Of course I'd go dogs. Sure. There's just so many dogs. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, you want to recreate that scene from Up. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a perfect choice. For me, it would be the hyper-intelligent sharks from Deep Blue Sea, because I have this small business idea where we are going to go around and get paid for interrupting important speeches. Basically, like a shark filibuster. Buster.
I think we saw two very different films, my friend.
I think we did. But you know what? Let's go ahead and start the show.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hey, everybody, guess what? You might not believe it, but it's Junk Food Cinema. We are back. We have things left over to talk about.
We're back from outer space. We walked in here to find you just, you know, something or something with that look on your face.
You know what we found? We found a 2016 that is killing all of our heroes. It's like all of those post-apocalyptic films we watched. When we left in 2015, everything seemed okay with the planet, and we get back, and I don't know what you guys did. I don't know what you did while we were gone, but everybody's dying, and we're not okay with that.
Wait, no, hold on a second. Of all people, you should be with me on this, on not, you know, everybody's like blowing 2016 out of proportion for taking our heroes, which has admittedly has taken a few, but 2015 was terrible for those of us 80s lovers.
No, that's true, but 2016 is literally like 2 weeks old and has already claimed so many. It's kind of like the rate at which it's consuming our heroes is a little bit staggering.
Yeah, but when you add all of them together, they all add up to one Rowdy Roddy Piper. I mean, when we're taking it in historical context here, I mean, we're talking Rowdy Roddy Piper. We lost him in 2015. And just add up those of 2016 so far, and you come to, which is, it is now a metric unit, one Roddy Piper.
See, I don't know. Roddy Piper's Canadian. I don't do metrics. I don't know the conversion rate, but I get what you're saying. All I'm saying is 2016, knock it off. That's why we're here. We are here to celebrate these people before they leave us. And today's movie will surely celebrate those people that you probably haven't talked about in a while, but we will fix that. But first, I want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. Yeah, we're still on both of those places. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Now, before we get started, I think it only fair to explain to you, our beloved listeners, the junkies, why we have been absent, give a little bit of context as to our absence of late. And there were some things brewing that we couldn't really talk about at the time that now cats have been let out of proverbial bags. And we can, in fact, tell you that it's all Cargill's fault.
Yeah, Brian, go ahead and blame me. Yeah, oh, it's all Cargill's fault.
Let's break this down mathematically. I watch movies, and you're currently making one.
Yeah, a little one, I mean, I guess.
I don't remember the name of it. It's like Dr. Gore.
Dr. Mordred. We're remaking Dr. Mordred. The 1992 Charles Band film. No, of course, I'm making Doctor Strange.
See, I thought it was Dr. Tarr's Torture Dungeon, and now you're telling me it's Doctor Strange, which I think is made by Marvel.
Oh, I kind of wish I was making Dr. Tarr's Torture Dungeon. Like, not instead of this, but I think that needs to be my next project.
That would be a considerable step in a different direction from Doctor Strange. So, How is life in the, and that's the other thing too, is the reason that, that Cargill sounds like he's not in the same room as me is because he's not. He is in fact in Cheerio London, and how are things going?
Things are going great. I mean, we're, you know, it's movie making and it's awesome. And I'm working with an unreal cast and an amazing crew. And it's day in, day out movie making. I mean, I'm literally sitting here in my dark apartment in the dark of freezing cold January, after having done a full day on the film. And when I'm done here with you junkies, I'm going to crawl into bed and get as much of a good night's sleep as I can before I do it again tomorrow. And it's awesome. It's just so much crazy fun.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the time difference, but I'm pretty sure it's February where you are, correct?
Yes, that's how it works. It's January in Texas, which means it's February in London.
Yes, and everything else I know of London, I learned from Bedknobs and Broomsticks, so yeah.
And Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties.
That is, yeah, wow. We made it almost 5 minutes into the episode before we made a reference to Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties. Hooray! And welcome back.
Have we ever made a reference to A Tale of Two Kitties before?
No, but it just speaks to the continual sliding scale of the quality that is junk food cinema. So welcome back, everybody. I'm sure you missed us. Well, we decided that we were going to kind of forego any kind of theme for the next few episodes and just talk about a bunch of movies that we've been wanting to talk about for a long time. That maybe didn't necessarily fit into any kind of a slot, any kind of a well-constructed box. So we're throwing caution to the wind and just talking about a few of our deep-fried favorites. And the first of which is one that I would venture that if you had cable at any time during the early 90s through probably 2000.
No, try the early 80s.
Oh, the early 80s. I mean, I think it probably continued on for a good 15 years or so. But yes, yeah, starting in the early 80s, a little film from Don Coscarelli, 1982's Beastmaster.
Behold the wonder, the horror, the fantasy, the challenge of the one warrior they call Beastmaster. Mark Singer is Dar. Tanya Roberts is Carrie. Rip Torn is Mayak. John Amos is Seth. Together they take us on a fascinating journey back into unexplored times. Conquer your fears. Face the unknown. And discover the incredible link between man, animal, and all that is phantasmagorical in the world of Dungeons, Dragons, and Dar. The Beastmaster.
We're talking Beastmaster today.
Yeah. No, in fact, you make the joke about cable. It used to show on HBO all throughout the 80s. Constantly, to where people would joke about the fact that HBO actually stood for, hey, Beastmaster's on. And then in the 90s, it kind of, you know, HBO wasn't showing that anymore because it was now an old movie. So now it was in syndication and it was on TBS all the time, which became known as the Beastmaster showing. And those jokes ran for years because that movie was always fucking on, because I swear to God, Don Coscarelli sold that movie for a wooden nickel. Like whatever it was one of those movies like Battle Beyond the Stars, where the rates to show it were non-existent. And so the movie played over and over and over again. And us boys of a certain age grew up with that. I cannot tell you how many times as a kid I saw Beastmaster. It is physically impossible to tell you how many times, because I don't know. Because every time it was on, I fucking watched the goddamn thing, because it's fucking Beastmaster. It's awesome. And it's just, it's one of those movies that it's a cultural touchstone for Gen Xers, as that movie we all saw we don't know how many times.
It's crazy, too, because it came out in a time when it was not a rarity to have, you know, these sort of shoestring budget sword and sandal movies do well. In fact, when it came out, I mean, it ran the risk of being lost to that white noise. But I think there are a couple different things about Beastmaster that set it apart from even the sword and sandal movies that we love. I mean, it's a very different animal, so to speak. And I think part of it is that it's sort of like Frank Franzetti as Dr. Doolittle. It's a movie that combines sort of the oiled up musculature of sword and sandal movies with this kind of very, I don't really know how to put it, but this love of all things fauna, and then smash all of that together with some truly horrific shit fitting of a guy like Don Coscarelli, and you have the recipe for a movie that stands head and shoulders above even movies with giant broad head and shoulders.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, it's you say lost to the noise. This movie came out in the patron saint year of junk food cinema. If there was one year in history that you could pluck out, Brian, and hold aloft as the epitome, the golden measure of what all junk food should be, what year would you say that was?
Probably 1982, yeah.
Yeah, and this is 1982. This movie came out 3 months after Conan the Barbarian. As much as everyone would like to count this as a Conan the Barbarian ripoff, this movie is just 3 months later and still manages to look like an amazing knockoff. And yet it's got so much magic charm and something special to it that makes it very much its own. Which is, you know, which comes from Coscarelli, frankly. And of course, Coscarelli, you know, he was drawing from the Conan roots when he made this. But it really is kind of a delightfully strange little oddity that is endlessly amusing.
Yeah, and let's talk for just a moment about the plot of Beastmaster here. I mean, this takes place in the kingdom of Arrak, and it's a place that is sort of besieged by a priest who is sort of the king's sorcerer, but has gone a little he's gone a little crazy he's got a little zealous with his faith and has decided that he hears about a prophecy that the unborn son of the king is going to spell doom. I mean, it's very Shakespearean in that way, where it's like he gets this prophecy that this, you know, the unborn son of the king is going to be the person that destroys him, so he hatches a plot to. And wait a minute, actually, no, less Shakespearean, more Old Testament, where it's like, well, there's a child that's going to be born and will spell doom for you. So he sets about trying to rid the kingdom of this child and then trying to rid the kingdom of the king and set himself up as leader. And meanwhile, you know, the child is growing up in this peaceful village where he's slowly learning that he has this unique ability to communicate with wild beasts. And, you know, the stories start to overlap when that village is completely decimated by these warriors who are operating sort of at the aegis of our villain, played by Rip Torn as Mayax. Now, don't be fooled by the fact that his name is totally spelled Max. It is pronounced Mayax because of the extra A. But yeah, it all kind of culminating into the hero's journey of having to kind of save what's left of his people and, you know, seek revenge and then learn who he is and what that means. And I mean, a story that does really combine elements of, you know, the Old Testament, of, you know, Shakespearean kind of themes. And then on top of that, he can talk to animals, and he develops this cadre of animal pals, you know, a tiger that is spray painted black, a golden eagle, and a pair of ferrets. And all of these things together combine into what we have with Beastmaster, which is so bizarre and so excellent at the same time.
Was the tiger actually spray painted black?
It was actually spray painted black. This is something I learned doing a little bit of research on the movie, is that if you watch the movie at certain points, it, like, you can see the stripes underneath, because there's not really any such thing as a black tiger. They just took a regular orange and black Bengal tiger and spray painted it black.
Because it's more fantastical that way.
Because it's more fantastical that way. And because if you really start looking into it, this, even though these are animals that exist on Earth, this can't possibly be any point in Earth's timeline, because those animals have completely separate habitats. So there's no one place on the planet at any point in history where you could go, oh, golden eagles, Bengal tigers, and ferrets live in the same place, that he would just happen upon them, you know, walking distance from his village to Mayax's stronghold. But yeah, at certain points during the movie, if you watch, you can see the stripes underneath, because apparently every time the tiger would take a drink, it would wash off some of its makeup, so to speak. It's spray paint, and so that was a constant problem on set, of having to touch up the tiger's makeup. That's Beastmaster in a nutshell. But what's great about it to me is, you look at a movie like Beastmaster, and coming off of Phantasm, which is, of course, where most people know Don Coscarelli, or, you know, where people who haven't really looked into him as a filmmaker since Phantasm still remember Phantasm, because it is such an incredible, dreamlike, very Italian-influenced, you know, horror film. And then you look at going...
Which, by the way, has a big 4K transfer that's just been done and is apparently gorgeous.
Oh, I got to check that out. The Phantasm is one of my favorite horror films, so absolutely going to be checking that out. But you go from that to Beastmaster, and, you know, just kind of on the surface, you may look at it and go, that is a huge leap. There's not a lot in Beastmaster that would make you think Don Coscarelli, this horror filmmaker, except that there are elements of Beastmaster that are truly horrific. Like, really nasty stuff is happening. Yeah. I mean, you have a child who's basically abducted by magic from his mother's womb and placed into the womb of an ox.
Of a fatted calf.
Of a fatted calf. You have these vampire hawk people, like these... I don't even know what, like vampire mummy people that suck the life out of people and reduce them to bones. You have, you know, like children being sacrificed in the movie. Like, it is, like, truly just an unsettling piece of fiction that happens to take place within the world of a sword and sandal flick.
Yeah. And it's got a lot of inventiveness to it too, which is what is part of the real charm of this. And you mentioned and kind of glossed over what I think is the big, you know, the biggest idea here to be found in Beastmaster, which are those unnamed beasts, the crazed, gossamer winged, strange mummy people that wrap people up in their wings and then kind of devour them in some bizarre way and drop them in a puddle of goo and bones. And those things are freaking creepy. And those things,
they're terrifying.
They are, and they're really neat. And they play into the end of this movie in a very cool way. They're such a strange little thing, and they're so Coscarellian. I mean, that's the thing, is that Coscarelli at heart, no matter what he does, there's touches of horror that he adds, and this is one of the big ones. Other things that you didn't mention that I absolutely love about this that are very horror-driven are, you know, there are these hags, which are very much based on, you know, the various myths of the...
Macbeth's witches.
They actually have this ring that they can use to spy on people, which is an eyeball that opens up and can look around and see everything in the area. And there's a moment in the film when the Beastmaster realizes what's going on and stabs the eye on the ring. And rather than it being like a gem eye or anything like that, it's a real fucking eye that's in there. And of course, you get the, you know, a stabbed eye on a stick. And of course, which has one of the witches screaming in pain because it was really her eye. Like, this is exactly the type of stuff Coscarelli loves playing around with. And as much as this is high fantasy, there's some really dark elements in there. Child sacrifice as part of Mayax's ways to appease the gods. There's some, you know, these great slaves that are tortured until they can't take it anymore, and they have this weird goo poured into their brains, and they become these mad berserkers that will tear you to bits. There's just tons of ideas. This entire movie is just riddled with ideas that sound like Don Cascarelli's fucked up D&D campaign turned into 2 hours of pure entertainment.
And that's exactly what we get. And I think that's what keeps, because, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of this sort of go-to signature silly touches that kind of identified sword and sandal movies of this era. Like, there's a lot of loincloth. Like, just like this movie actually may have the smallest costumes for both male and female characters of any sword and sandal film I have ever seen. Like, it is crazy
for everybody.
For every, yeah, it is equal opportunity. Like, it is, but it's still crazy how little fabric. I think that's maybe how the movie was able to be accomplished on a small budget, because they spent almost no money on fabric. I think one ream of fabric clothed the entire cast. But, you know, I think all of these horror elements that are legitimately unsettling and the things you can't take your eyes off of are one of the things that offset that and keep this from ever really feeling as campy as it kind of should, as a movie about a warrior who is taking on an evil sorcerer and can talk to animals. Like, just on paper, that sounds like the kind of thing that should be incredibly campy. But all of these horror elements, all of these darker touches are the things that I think really make this so different from a lot of the sword and sandal movies and keep it from kind of verging into camp territory.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, let's be fair. There's a lot of camp here. As much as I love this movie, rewatching it really did highlight elements of camp. And you're right about the costumes. You know, and you're like, hey, well, you know, we're talking Mark Singer in his heyday and Tanya Roberts. And it's like, yeah, we're also talking about John Amos after he was the dad on Good Times. Like, this is, you know, and we're talking, thank Christ, Rip Torn is mostly covered.
It's true. Thank God for small favors.
But yeah, no, there are some elements to this that really do save it from being, you know, just another campy sword and sandal send-up. And I think the biggest thing is what Coscarelli did structurally with the Beastmaster. And the way he's telling the story here is what differentiates Dar, you know, Mark Singer's hero, in this, is that Dar isn't a Mary Sue. He is a guy who has a destiny, and he has this power. And the power is to communicate with, not just communicate with the beasts, but also be able to see through their eyes and have them see through his, and to know his thoughts. And he uses that not to control animals, but to make a whole bunch of friends that join his party, that they then all fill different roles, making up for his weaknesses. And as he goes along, he's got such a good heart and he's such a good guy that he ends up making friends with all these other people that also start filling in those holes. So what you have is a story that, while it's centered around this hero and it's, you know, it's titular hero, it also really is a movie about this guy doing the right thing for people, and then all of these people pulling together to do this. He is not solely responsible for getting through every every challenge that comes his way. Quite the contrary, he only gets by because of all the friends he makes in this movie. And I think that's what really makes the Beastmaster work. And the level, what it does in terms of the level of fantasy that it's offering, what it's doing is it's kind of playing on that youthful desire to want to be, you know, want to be liked and want to be accepted and want to do the right thing, and then have friends as awesome as you imagine yourself to be. And that's every bit what Beastmaster is. It's this guy, this loner, who ends up with, by the end of the movie, a dozen different allies that all kind of come through for him at exactly the right time, getting him where he needs to be to do what he needs to do, so that when he's called upon to be the hero, he's there and supported. And that is really kind of the charm of this movie, is watching him make all these friends and then watch all of his friends do these awesome things.
He gets by with a little help from his friends, is what Cargill is essentially saying, which is true. And I think it's funny, we talked about D&D. What he's really doing is it's not a singular hero story. He's building a guild. And honestly, like, it feels at times less like, you know, a Conan story and more like a, you know, a Hobbit or a Lord of the Rings type story, where, like you said, every member of this guild has a specific skill, right down to the fact that the ferrets he keeps calling thieves, which is exactly what Bilbo was called by the dwarves in The Hobbit. He's the thief. That was his job. That was his function on the team. And that's kind of what the ferrets do too. They get into small places and they take things. And in fact,
we need to stop calling them the ferrets. This
Why?
Is goddamn Kodo and Podo.
I'm sorry, Kodo and Podo. Yes, they do have names. Not all ferrets look alike to me. That's a very fair point. But it would not be until Kindergarten Cop where, again, ferrets would have this kind of mainstream exposure. So I think we really do have to thank Beastmaster for putting ferrets into the mainstream and giving them the big budget FaceTime, you know, that they would be sorely missing for the next 10 years or so. But I do have to say, like, as someone who I have a soft spot for, you know, usually dogs, but really just all animals in movies, like, I love the fact that the way that the animals are treated in this movie, and I'm not talking about on set because I can't really speak to that, but as far as the way they're treated within the narrative, they are legitimately his friends, and there is a caring that is established to the point that you as an audience member start to care for these animals. And there's a couple of moments in the film of animals sacrificing themselves for Dar that are really, really moving.
Oh yeah.
Like there's a scene early in the film where a wolf or a dog, I'm not really sure how you would break it down in this particular historical era, takes an arrow to the chest and continues to drag Dar away from danger. And then the next scene kind of fades in on Dar out of danger coming around, and the dog has since died. And it's a very moving scene because it's not played up for, it's strange. The stakes are different, I guess, in that scene than a scene you would normally see where a dog gets a, you know, a bolt from a crossbow and is just dead. And it's kind of a cheap knee-jerk reaction to kind of trick you into feeling like you felt something. And now this is like a relationship that is told within the span of a few seconds. Like, you really do feel something for this animal that has sacrificed itself to bring our hero out of danger.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And then of course later in the film, one of the other animals sacrifices itself in such a way that it just kind of guts you. It's rough, and thankfully there's a tiny little positive moment a little later tied into that that makes you feel a little better about the sacrifice. And yet still, it's one of those, everybody listening to this podcast right now who's seen the Beastmaster knows exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, they're having that, holding back those little man tears while beating on their chest going, my boy, saved everybody.
The scene you're talking about that relieves a little bit of that, I've called the coda for Kodo, which is...
And yeah. Here I was trying to avoid, you know, a major spoiler there. But then again, we kind of stopped doing that. So, yeah, no.
I'm sorry. This is Beastmaster, guys. And I get, like, here's the deal. Just going forward with Junk Food Cinema, it's a tiny bit of housekeeping here. We're going to start telling you guys the movies that we're covering in advance so that you can go out and watch them. So please consider every discussion henceforth about every movie to be a completely open discussion, because we're essentially giving you homework and then expecting you to have done that homework, because nothing makes a podcast more fun than assignments. So that's what we're going to do. So just keep in mind from going forward, we'll probably discuss the films a little bit more specifically and a little bit more openly. So yes, the coda for Kodo definitely brought a little bit of wateriness to my eye for sure.
Yeah, and it's kind of a sad death too. Like, just the way, when you realize that Dar is not really responsible for saving the day at the end of the movie. Like, he...
No, not at all.
Like, what it comes down to, by the way, when it comes down to him, you know, what you think is the villain, you know, because that's one of the weird things about this movie, is the movie ends, and then the movie's not over.
Yes! Oh my god, I'm so glad we got to talk about that. That third act is so befuddling, because it's like, hold on. Any other movie, that guy goes down. Your James Earl Jones has turned into a snake and then been vanquished. This shit is done, right?
Yeah.
No.
He's over.
No. Not so much with Beastmaster.
No, because, remember that evil horde we told you about? The horde that actually kind of rode in and killed everybody that Dar cared about at the beginning of the movie? Yeah, we still have to fight them. And that's going to be an interesting fight on its own. So for about 15 seconds, the movie becomes The Seven Samurai. And
yeah, exactly.
And
yes.
they start prepping the town for the big fight. And you're like, oh, I've seen this. This is the Fantasy A-Team. Okay, right on. And then then our evil horde rides into town. And then we have this big, long, like 5-minute fight between what is ostensibly our final boss villain, who has had, you know, almost no personality. He's essentially Lord Humongous without the talking.
But with an excellent helmet. That helmet is on point. It's got the bat wings coming off the top of it. It looks fantastic.
Oh, the helmet's amazing. I mean, and this is, I mean, Don Coscarelli has always been great at iconography. And
sure.
That's another thing that this movie really, you know, excels at, is this movie, you know, what few things he had the budget for, they look fucking cool. And so they have this big fight, and then once again he does not win because he is the best or because he is the strongest. He wins because earlier in the film he accidentally made friends with these evil bird monster people.
Yeah.
And was given a totem by them. And so he sent that totem off with his eagle to go get help from them. And they show up at just the right time to come and eat all the bad guys.
If this movie were remade today, Dar would not be the same hero. In fact, he wouldn't even be a person. He would be an app. He would be an app on your phone that you bring up to contact the people that you actually need to help you. His function in this movie is to stumble across all of the exact right components to make the to have the thing that needs to happen ultimately happen. but not by his own hand. So really what he is he's a summoning for all of the things that you need to actually show up and save the day. So if the reason they can't really remake Beastmaster, in my opinion, is because Dar would just be an app. He wouldn't even be a person.
Well, you know, but see, that is part of what I really love about this and what I've loved about revisiting it, because it's one of those things that Dar was prophesized to bring about the end of this empire, you know, the end of these evil dudes.
Which is a very careful choice of words there if you listen to that. He's going to bring it about. He's not actually going to do it, but he's going to be responsible for bringing it about.
Yes, and so he ends up being the centerpiece of this whole rebellion and of all of these things that are coming together to beat the bad guys. So he's he's that force that brings everyone onto the same page so that everyone can, you know, ultimately triumph. But of course, you know, he gets all the credit and he gets the title of the movie. So, 'cause the movie's called The Beastmaster. And why wouldn't it be? Because that's fucking awesome.
It's true. But I keep thinking about when the June Horde, when they beat Rip Torn, but they're still out there and they have to just... It would be like at the end of Return of the Jedi when they're like burning Vader's suit. And then all of a sudden all the bounty hunters show up and they're like, oh shit, no one told them the job was off. No one told them that they weren't getting paid, so they're still trying to get Han Solo. So that, to me, it would be like the most recognizable analog was like, imagine at the end of Jedi, after Vader and the Empire have fallen, you still got to deal with the goddamn bounty hunters. That's pretty much the fourth act, I'm going to call it the fourth act of the Beastmaster.
Well, yeah, no, it's very much like Casino Royale has this same issue. And then Speed, you know, the movie Speed. What's the movie Speed about?
A bus.
Yes. And then eventually they defuse the bomb on the bus and it's like, oh yeah, the movie's over. It's like, no, we still have to go kill Dennis Hopper.
Oh shit, we forgot about Dennis Hopper.
And so now we have to go and have this other chase. Because that's what that movie was. And Casino Royale has that where it's like, oh, Le Chiffre's dead, but we haven't killed everybody yet. So, yeah. And so that's what this is Rip Torn gets thrown into the fire and it's like, yay, the movie's over. It's like, yeah, no, movie's not over yet. There's still like 20 minutes left. We still have to have Mark Singer roll around in the dirt for 5 minutes with a guy with a badass helmet.
Look, we paid for that loincloth. We're going to get every mile of usage out of it that we possibly can. Fourth act.
And why wouldn't you?
And why wouldn't you? It's a dynamite dashing loincloth. I do find it funny. We mentioned before that a lot of people saw this and thought it was a Conan ripoff. Apparently, after seeing this, Dino De Laurentiis offered Conan the Destroyer to Don Coscarelli. So Don Coscarelli was kind of the first person offered the job of directing Conan the Destroyer, but he declined because he didn't like the script for Conan the Destroyer. And I have a theory that based on Beastmaster, what he actually didn't like is the idea that Conan would punch a camel. Because you know who wouldn't punch a camel?
The Beastmaster.
Yes, that's why I swear to God, I have this vision in my head of him being okay with the script, reading that scene and going, oh no, Dar would never do that, and therefore my Conan would never do that. Thank you, but no, I shall have to decline. Because...
Well, but since you know Conan punches a camel, you've seen Conan the Destroyer.
Yeah.
And you know the script for Conan the Destroyer ain't fucking good.
That's true. Yeah, no, let me be perfectly clear about this. Conan punching a camel is not the only problem with Conan the Destroyer.
Far from it.
It may not even broach the top 20 problems with Conan the Destroyer. However, that would be the thing that I think would probably be the oh my God, I can't believe I'm about to say this. The straw that broke the camel's back when Coscarelli was making that decision.
I hate you so much.
As well you should. But can we talk for a second about the score for Beastmaster? Because there is this incongruity between the level of film I think that is being made, and the score for that film, because the score for Beastmaster is relentlessly exciting, like to the point that I'm
it's epic as fuck.
It really is, to the point that I'm like, what movie did this composer think that they were making? Like, this is like jacked up James Horner. Like, it's crazy good.
No, it's really a big, magnificent score, and it almost feels like a favor. It's either a favor score or it's somebody trying to prove themselves score, where they're like, "Look, I know that you're not making a big movie, but I'm directing. I'm composing a big movie score."
And he absolutely did. I mean, this composer, Lee Holdridge. Yeah, I know. All of you Lee Holdridge fans out there are going to be quite excited that we name-dropped him a little bit. You know, not exactly a guy that is known at all, but this score is like, it is so much bigger than even the scope of the world that's being created. And that's actually impressive, considering there aren't a lot of corners that feel like they were being cut. And at least in my impression of the movie, watching it, was it doesn't feel like a lot of corners are being cut. I mean, you have shots of Dar training that are clearly, you know, these wide sweeping helicopter shots, and just, it feels like there were a lot of people who, you know, much in the junk food cinema tradition, and the reason that we love a lot of these films, there's so many people on this movie who were just absolutely giving it their all and not deterred at all by the fact that they were making yet another, you know, sweaty sword and sandal, you know, kind of adventure movie. Like, these are people that saw this as, you know, something to which they owed their best work, and I'll be damned if they didn't do it. And I think that's what makes this movie so magnetic and so impossibly likable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of freaking awesome.
It kind of is.
The thing is, it's just that those notes, they hit you, and They really do help this movie feel much larger than it is, because this is a movie that you know, when you take a look at the production values, like, you're right in that there are some really high production value moments, and then there's a lot of really close up shots trying to hide just how small the budget is, and you know, there are times where it really does feel like it's shot in somebody's backyard in California, before you go to, you know, out into the middle of nowhere and he's on top of a mountain swinging a sword around while the helicopter circles. And, you know, it's, but this score never feels cheap. It always makes the movie feel huge. And I think it's one of those really great scores by a relatively unknown composer.
And I think another thing that really aids the movie is that somebody figured out that Tanya Roberts is best when you don't give her a heck of a lot of lines, which is unfortunately a lesson that would be completely forgotten for her next role, the role that this movie got her, which was in A View to a Kill as the main Bond girl, which in my mind stands as bottom three worst James Bond films of all time, and no small part of that is her performance. However, in this, it's like, it's measured. It's like somebody figured out the exact equation of how much screen time and how many lines to give to Tanya Roberts to effectively utilize her in the movie.
Yeah. But Tanya Roberts is far from the worst thing in A View to a Kill. I feel like hanging that on her is a little
rough. I'm not hanging it all on her. I'm just saying that she's not helping matters but at all, and is not at all a good Bond girl, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that they just give her way too much to say. I just think that she's one of those performers who's best when It sounds really pedantic, and I don't mean it to, but like maybe don't give her so many lines, and she'll be okay.
Well, she is really just the eye candy in this movie. Like, if there's anything to be said for this movie, is this movie's not the most egalitarian of films. It's borders on a little tad bit misogynistic.
Oh, come now. It totally is. I mean, that's something you come to expect from an early 80s sword and sandal, like, you know, swashbuckling adventure.
Certainly. But my point is that, you know, Tanya Roberts is there for her one nude scene in the movie. There's reportedly two. Don Coscarelli actually told me once there's a second one, and it's hidden as an Easter egg on the DVD. And it's not something that I've ever found, but it is, you know, she was a very beautiful woman who was cast to be a very beautiful woman so that Mark Singer could get a very beautiful woman at the end of the movie.
Yeah, there's a scene in the movie where he uses the tiger to convince her she's in danger and then convince her that he's rescued her. And then he literally says to her, "You owe me your life, but I'll accept this as payment," and then just tries to have his way with her. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of the caliber of chivalry that I expect in a sword and sandal sword movie.
Yeah. Loincloth wearing barbarians tend not to be the best feminists,
as it turns out. But I do want to ask you this question. John Amos's costume versus all of the costumes in The Road Warrior, which one is the most fabulous on a BDSM scale?
On an Outlaws of Gore scale, I'd probably still have to go Mad Max, but John Amos is a close second.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you are thinking of starting your own horror site and you haven't jumped on the name Outlaws of Gore, why haven't you done that? I want to see a website called The Outlaws of Gore just be about, like, your favorite, I don't know, Fulci movies or something. That's a terrific fucking title.
Yeah, except are you familiar with Gore or Outlaws of Gore?
I'm familiar with the movie Gore. I didn't know there was an Outlaws of Gore.
Oh, yes, which is the sequel and based on a book series that is all about BDSM. And It gets worse and worse as the series goes on, and anybody that's ever been associated with the whole Gore series online has learned their lesson to avoid that. So if you start an Outlaws of Gore site, G-O-R-E, you're likely to get some old Gore fans showing up, talking about the type of sexual fantasies that will make your Gore pale by comparison.
So just keep that in mind. And also, as you watch Beastmaster, if you have a problem with Tanya Roberts's performance, just remember that the actress that Coscarelli really wanted for that role was an 18-year-old Demi Moore, and the producers forced him instead to cast Tanya Roberts.
Oh, that's kind of crazy.
Right? We could have had it. This could have been the big breakthrough role for Demi Moore. Would have been as Kiri in this film. But you know what? I wanted to go back for a second to that scene that you talked about with the warriors kind of being transformed into berserker monsters. That's another thing that I think if you watch this movie immediately after watching Phantasm, kind of bleeds over as connective tissue. Where, you know, in Phantasm you have this kind of nether realm where people are being transformed into these you know, half men, servants of the demon, you know, like these really kind of twisted and sinister creatures. And in this film, kind of that version in this film is, you know, they drop the slugs from SETI Alpha 5 into the guy's ears and turn them into these, you know, again, make them lose their humanity and become just these servant creatures. And I feel like that's,
this is SETI Alpha 5.
That's true. So you have a lot of things going on, but I feel like there are these little moments that if you pay attention, like you can totally see Don Coscarelli's fingerprints, even though this movie is operating technically within an entirely different genre.
Also, might want to point out, 1982, just shortly before Beastmaster came out, also when Wrath of Khan came out.
It really is like the nexus. Like, it's the nexus of everything that is junk food cinema. And what's crazy about that is that means junk food cinema existed in some nascent form on this planet even before I did. So, I didn't create junk food cinema. Junk food cinema created us. Like, I think it's really weird. It's kind of the serpent eating its own tail, and we'll make you go cross-eyed and have like a Lovecraftian level of complete madness. So don't think about it too much, but it is kind of interesting to note. But yeah, Beastmaster, another thing that'll really make Beastmaster great, and I highly recommend doing this for the experience, is to watch Beastmaster and then immediately follow it up with Beastmaster 2. Through the portal of time.
No. Why did this episode just go off the rails all of a sudden? Because we had gone this long. We had gone nearly 50 minutes without mentioning Beastmaster 2 even existed.
It needs to be known and it needs to be watched so that you understand how you can fuck up a sequel. Like how cataclysmically you can fuck up a very basic idea. And in the sequel, that very basic idea is the world of Beastmaster. Let's incorporate 90s LA into that universe, and it absolutely I actually was enjoying it until Kerry Wulff showed up. Like, until they went to LA and found like the most unlikable female protagonist I think I've ever seen in a film of this era. I was having fun with it, but then it became completely unwatchable. And it's so sad because I was enjoying, is it Wings Hauser plays the bad guy? And I was like on board for all of that. And then it was like, oh, these cops suddenly go through the portal and they're in Beastmaster's time and they're saying things not like, oh my God, what the fuck just happened? Who are these people? Why are we in a different era? But, oh, this report's going to be a real bitch to fill out. And I was like, okay, no. No, fuck all of this. You have failed. I can't believe this is a real movie. But I think it really does demand that you watch it so that you understand how a sequel can absolutely irrevocably destroy all of the goodwill created by the original film.
You know something has gone terribly wrong and gone off the rails when you remember it fondly with Masters of the Universe and remember Masters of the Universe being the superior version of this story.
Wow. Yeah, no. We have just indicted.
I'm not wrong, am I? Time.
You're not wrong at all. It's just the ultimate indictment, I think, of any film when Masters of the Universe is the superior when found weighed in the scales. Like, oh my gosh, that you have to have made a real just shit show of a movie if Masters of the Universe is looked upon favorably in comparison. But it's absolutely true. Through the Portal of Time is nonsense. And there's a made-for-TV third one that I haven't actually seen.
Oh, with Casper Van Dien.
With Casper Van Dien and David Warner. So my interest is piqued, but I have a feeling after not being able to sit through all of Through the Portal of Time that the third one is only going to get I'm only going to get less into it before I switch it off.
Yeah, that I'm telling you now, having seen it. Yeah, it Beastmaster's like it's a lot like Highlander in that there should be only one. That, you know, there's just you. That, sure, there are a number of others. Just pretend they don't exist and pretend it is a thing on its own. Beastmaster is a movie that, campy though it is, it still has a magic and it has a lot of craftsmanship and a lot of great ideas that make for a really highly entertaining 2 hours that still holds up as an entertaining sword and sandals flick. Everything after that is really just punishing yourself.
Absolutely. Now I want to run down this list very quickly. But I'm going to just do 1982. These are the sword and sorcery flicks that came out just in the year 1982. We have Ator the Invincible. We have The Beastmaster, Conan the Barbarian, The Flight of Dragons, which is an animated film, Sorceress, The Sword and the Sorcerer. That is all just 1982.
Yeah, I love all of those, but Ator.
Yeah, the Miles O'Keefe, man, he just never, like, he never had it, and they kept trying to force Ator on people, and to the point that, like, that of this entire list that I'm looking at, the only movie that ever ended up as part of a Mystery Science Theater spoof was one of the Ator movies, Cave Dwellers. So yeah, do with that what you will, but.
Yeah, but Sorceress deserves MST3K-ing. It's just so amazingly hilarious in how bad it is and how badly it fails that you can't help but love the terrible little thing. So I would not put it up there with in the caliber with the others. Yeah. Because Sword and the Sorcerer, that's one we should probably talk about at some point down the road.
For sure, absolutely.
Because that is such a fun movie. And the only good film by that director.
The Sword and the Sorcerer is the only good film by that director?
Yeah.
By Albert Pune. Okay, well, there you go.
Yes.
So, yes. Okay. One more question before we move on to our junk food pairing. Of all of the sword and sorcery films of the entire 1980s, we're talking starting with Hawk the Slayer and going all the way to Willow, where does Beastmaster fall for you in your tops of that category?
It's up there at the very top. I mean, Beastmaster is one of my absolute deep fried favorites. It does so much different. Like, you look at all of those films, and one of the big problems is what I mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, is that almost all those films, they suffer from Mary Sue syndrome. You know, they're one great hero who saves everyone constantly. And this movie really rides upon that, this great notion of this guy just being kind of in service to his prophecy, as opposed to the prophecy turning him into the one great badass. And it's a story of a boy being forged into a hero, and I love that. And I love how it works, and I love the cast, and I love the magic that Coscarelli got out of this. So I put this above most of the others. You can't put it above the first Conan, because Conan the Barbarian is just an amazing film. But I don't know what I would put above Beastmaster.
I think I know. I think I know what you would put above Beastmaster, because it's the same one that I would put just above Beastmaster. And in fact, I would put Beastmaster above Conan, but my top one remains Krull. I still think Krull is my favorite of the sword and sorcery movies of this era.
I love Krull, but I don't know that I love Krull more than Beastmaster.
Ooh, interesting. Controversy. Yeah. Intrigue.
No. I would argue that Krull has the far superior score. As much as Beastmaster's score is great, Krull's score is fucking awesome. But in terms of sword and sandals flicks, maybe I'd go Beastmaster over Krull, but it's a close one. You are right. It is very close.
Well, yeah, I mean, Beastmaster has a composer doing his damnedest to sound like James Horner, whereas Krull has James Horner. Horn. Yeah, so I completely agree with that.
And so, into an age of darkness, in a time of mysticism, sacrifice, and plunder, there came the only light.
Well, that brings us to our junk food pairing, and I have gone with something. Basically, what I feel about the movie The Beastmaster is that it is comfort food in that it exists within a subgenre of films that we're very familiar with, that we like very much, the sword and sorcery stuff. So there's a lot about it that feels very traditional and comfortable in that. But it has also added things that make The Beastmaster like a truly horrific, sinister, like just like dark version of the sword and sorcery movie. So it's taken something comfortable and made it just really bleak and scary and dark. And it is for that reason that the junk food pairing is the hot dog crusted pizza from Domino's, because the pizza itself, very comfortable, something we like, no matter, there's so many different kinds of pizza, but basically, I mean, they all operate within a similar structure. But then you go and you add something to that pizza that makes it absolute nightmare fodder, and that is the idea of sticking miniature pigs in a blanket all around the edge of the crust. It is like you are trying to summon some kind of demon from another time by adding this really horrific element to something that we already loved so much. And I feel like Coscarelli has taken something that was so so beloved and just added this really horrific element to it, much like Domino's did when they added pigs in a blanket to the crust of their pizza. So that is the junk food pairing that I've gone with for the Beastmaster. Have you ever had the hot dog pizza at Domino's, Cargill?
I didn't even know that was a thing. This is the very first time hearing of it.
I don't even know if they do it anymore, but for a while it was a real thing. Like, you could get it in two different forms. You could get, like, I hesitate to say the regular version because there is nothing regular about this abomination.
And nor would you be after eating it.
No, you would absolutely not be. You could get that version, which is basically pigs in a blanket, or you could get the pretzel version, which was pigs in a blanket with a pretzel dough wrapping, and then they would serve it with mustard. Like, it's just, I can't even wrap my head around the concept of eating pizza with hot dogs at the end instead of crust. Like, that just seems like the pinnacle of gluttony.
I can't wrap my head around eating pizza with mustard. let's stop there at the hot dogs for a second. Pizza with mustard.
It's a fucked up world that Domino's wants us to live in. It is a dark world of a very barbaric age, and I don't think we're ready to go there.
It sounds so insane. I almost would believe Rip Torn was involved.
If Rip Torn becomes Domino's spokesperson in the next 5 years or so, there will be a completion of the circle. The gates will open. The last horseman will have saddled up and the apocalypse will be nigh. So just keep that in mind, people, if you ever see Rip Torn doing Domino's commercials. Well, that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema. So glad to be back. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. You can catch us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter. iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can follow us individually. Cargill, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm.
Awesome. And Doctor Strange is going to be released when?
In theaters November 4th.
Of this year?
Yeah.
Shit, dude. Get to work. It's already January and this movie's coming out in November. Come on, man. Get on it. You have to summon all that magic. There's so much magic that has to be captured within one film, and you got to get on that because it's already January.
Don't worry. We've got a Cumberbatch.
Oh, okay, good. Well, that's good to know. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And again, just if you like the show, make sure you tell as many people as you possibly can about it. Rate us, review us, and all the places you can do that. We really do appreciate that. So we're going to... Cargill, is there anything else you think that we have left off with Beastmaster before we go? I think we've covered as much ground as humanly possible. So definitely check it out. It is actually available. Both the first and second Beastmaster movies are available on YouTube, actually, of all places. You can actually watch that on YouTube. But we're going to go ahead and sign off. I want to remind you all that the gods have put their mark on you, and someday you'll find out why.